Untuk continue with our letters on yoga from volume 22. As you know, I had told you that I will read out some things on rebirth, because that's the chapter that we have completed in the Life Divine. So these letters do add a lot of clarification regarding this concept of rebirth. And of course, as you have seen already, they have given us some more details regarding rebirth, which were not so very evident, I must say, in the chapter The Life Divine. So this is another letter on page 451 of the same volume. You must avoid a common popular blunder about reincarnation. The popular idea is that Titus Balbus is reborn again as John Smith, a man with the same personality, character, attainments as he had in his former life, with the sole difference that he wears coat and trousers instead of a toga and speaks in Cockney English instead of popular Latin. That's not the case. What would be the earthly use of repeating the same personality or character a million times from the beginning of time till its end? The soul comes into birth for experience, for growth, for evolution, till it can bring the divine into matter. Well, I'm sure you catch the argument here, that there's never ever a repeat of an old birth, of a previous incarnation, of a previous personality. Because at each level, the only purpose of the soul's rebirth, seen from an ultimate point of view, is to really divinize matter. So this is, the philosophically, the ultimate aim of the rebirth. Although in the process, the soul does get enriched, gets more and more experience. But in a way, this question of enrichment would fall in line with the divinization of matter, because, you know, that means if there is an enriched soul, it has done its maximum possible manner, its work of connecting the divine force to matter and life. And the more one gets enriched, not only enriching is not just the number of births and the number of great person you have been. That means an enrichment is the more you have realized the divine consciousness, that is the true enrichment. It is not the question of, you know, have you been a great philosopher or a great writer or a great sportsman. Greatness has nothing to do with enrichment. So the enrichment is how close is the soul going towards the divine. See, the aura of enrichment is constituted of the divine consciousness and not with the human achievements. So that's what I would understand by an enrichment. So the more it becomes closer to the divine consciousness, the more it has connected the divine with matter. That is why we say the spiritual beings or the spiritual people are the highest in the order of evolution, and those are the people who are to be admired, for those are the people who should be the ideals of our life, because they have in every way helped humanity the most, right from divinizing matter to connecting the divine with life. So always what we want in life is somebody to connect us with the divine. So these vibhutis or these rishis or these great yogis, that is their function, to build bridge with the divine. And so we admire and adore, if I can say, only these people. Of course, the Western world has a different concept of admiration for those other normal human achievements too. They admire the individual's achievement in this world, and we admire the individual's achievement when he connects with this world to the divine. I mean, very evidently, if I can use the word. You see, you may say, I'm a great businessman, so why not I also can connect with the divine? You can, but most don't. Because most businessmen connect with the money, with materialism. But that's what Sri Aurobindo tells us, if you can bring the divine into your material life, well and good. But mostly it doesn't happen. As we know, politics and money are the last things to change. So that's why we say, those who are, say, closer in art, in dance forms, where there is an automatic and inevitable connection with your inner being, whereas most of the other works connect you to the outer world. So you have to make an effort to withdraw and connect yourself with the within. But if your outer expression is solidly something of the inner, that means the humanity side, you have greater chances. I would not say every artist is a yogi, not at all. But one has greater chances. So that is the word there, she says. The whole thing is an experience, a growth, an evolution, till it can bring the divine into matter. It is the central being that incarnates, not the outer personality. The personality is simply a mold that it creates for its figures of experience in that one life. In another birth, it will create for itself a different personality, different capacities, a different life and career. Supposing Virgil is born again, he may take up poetry in one or two other lives, but he will certainly not write an epic, but rather perhaps slight but elegant and beautiful lyrics such as he wanted to write but did not succeed in Rome. In another birth, he is likely to be no poet at all, but a philosopher and a yogin seeking to attain and to express the highest truth. But that too was an unrealized trend of his consciousness in that life. Perhaps before he had been a warrior or ruler doing deeds like Aeneas or Augustus before he sang them, and so on this side or that, the central being develops a new character, a new personality, grows, develops, passes through all kinds of terrestrial experience. As the evolving being develops still more and more, still more, and becomes more rich and complex, it accumulates its personalities as it were. Sometimes we stand behind the active elements, throwing in some colors, some traits, some capacity here and there, or to stand in front, and there is a multiple personality, a many-sided character or a many-sided, sometimes what looks like a universal capacity. I think in some other context we did discuss this. You see, when we have an accumulation of if I can say achieved personalities. That is, if an individual in a specific form or life achieves this experience of being a poet, or being an artist, or an architect, or something, where he has crystallized, yeah, that's the right word, where he has crystallized his personality. He has not remained an amorphous person that I am this and I am that and this. So what happens is, in each life, if he has become a crystallized personality, then that remains as part of your character. I mean, of course, it's not so much evident, but as you would say later on in the same letter, you would see that these personalities remain in the backdrop. So in one of his rebirths, those personalities may come and influence. So you would see some people are, you know, Ashwaravinda calls it, is a multiple personality. He is an architect, he is a poet, he is a scientist, he is a musician. And the couple of examples that I can really think of is, one of them is none other than Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, you see a multiple personality there, and each one of them a brilliant one. Whatever he did, be it science or medicine or music or art or sculpture or painting, whatever, in each one of them he excels. So that only means that there was a very enriched personal achievement in his previous births. So sometimes all of them come in front for the sake of the work, but other times they may have some kind of a background effect. I mean, he would be sensitive to poetry, he would have a feel for architecture, he would have a feel for this music. But he may not necessarily become a musician, like Leonardo was a musician, was an architect, it's all accomplished. But in some, there would be a perceptible influence. So that tells you, why I'm explaining all this, is that tells you that the soul is become more and more rich and complex. Some people are just one expression, so you can see from the evolutionary point of view, it is not a complex personality, a complex experience. Complex is not in the negative sense, it is in the right, in the positive sense. It is a personality which is enriched. So, of course, now the other example you see again only in Sri Aurobindo. There have been other personalities in history who have been this plus that plus this, couple of personalities. But we see diverse personalities in Leonardo, a brilliant example. And of course, Sri Aurobindo, they get not a personality as much, although the expressions may seem differently. Although for our human understanding, we have called him a psychologist and a sociologist and a poet and a dramatist. That I think the mind has made the splits in Sri Aurobindo. But in Leonardo, these aspects are evident, self-evident. He has produced books in medicine which are completely nothing to do with when he discovered a submarine. But in Sri Aurobindo, we do not see that kind of a divided personality saying, here is a Sri Aurobindo, the scientist and the poet and the literator. No. He's all one. We can see the singleness of the spiritual consciousness, and maybe that is the tenor of a spiritual consciousness. It can give knowledge, shed light on each aspect of human achievement, and yet itself or himself, the consciousness, not splitting up into a scientist and a doctor. And so this is the difference between Leonardo and Sri Aurobindo. So Sri Aurobindo has shed light on medicine, has shed light on science, but he has not really gone and really cut up a human body and brought about a medical science. Although he has shed a lot of light. That is what is a spiritual master is. He can give you light on every aspect of life. So here there is the multiple personality, a many-sided character or a many-sided, sometimes what looks like a universal capacity. I think instead of calling a multiple personality, we would rather agree with this, a many-sided, sometimes what looks like a universal personality. That is Sri Aurobindo. Many-sided, not multiple personality. But if a former personality, a former capacity is brought fully forward, it will not be to repeat what was already done, but to cast the same capacity into new forms and new shapes and fuse it into a new harmony of the being, which will not be a reproduction of what was before. Thus you must not expect to be what the warrior and the poet were. Something of the outer characteristics may reappear, but very much changed and new cast in a new combination. It is in a new direction that the energies will be guided to do what was not done before. This is also there, you get the point, that if somebody was a poet in one of his lives, it's not that forever he won't be a poet again. He may be a poet once again, but with a new harmony and a new capacity. That means if he has been a poet of nature, he may now become a poet of the mind. He may become a poet of the heart, or he may become a poet of spirituality. So in poetry also there are grades of higher expression. So it doesn't stop him from becoming once again a poet, but this time, as he says, to cast the, into new forms and new shapes and fuse it into a new harmony. So that is how again we see the greatness of a poet, how integral his expression is. And that's what we see in the growth of Sri Aurobindo the poet. I mean, starting with Songs to Myrtilla, which were, you know, in his youth, ending up with life, with the Savitri. You see the growth of a poet. It's in a single life, nevertheless. But still you see how this poet, starting with Songs to Myrtilla, comes across his long poems like Urvashi and, you know, Love and Death and all that. Then comes to sonnets, comes to longer sonnets, longer poems, and then in between there is the drama, which is again nothing but poetry, and then he ends up in Savitri. So you can almost see the evolution of the poet from the mental, emotional, to the pure spiritual. So you can see in Sri Aurobindo one span of his life, I mean several births of poets, as he puts it here, new shapes, new forms, new harmonies. So I think one could see Sri Aurobindo's poetry from that angle, it becomes extremely interesting. And then, something of the outer characteristics may reappear, but very much changed and new cast in a new combination. Another thing, it is not the personality, the character that is of the first importance in rebirth. It is a psychic being who stands behind the evolution of the nature and evolves with it. The psychic, when it departs from the body, shedding even the mental and vital on its way to its resting place, carries with it the heart of its experiences, not the physical events, not the vital movements, not the mental buildings, not the capacities or characters, but something essential that is gathered from them, what might be called the divine element, for the sake of which the rest existed. This is a permanent addition. It is that helps in the growth towards the divine. Now I skip here this longish letter. I go to another one on page 458. The psychic does not give up the mental and other sheaths, apart from the physical, immediately at death. It is said that it takes 3 years on the whole to get clear away from the zone of communicability with the earth, though there may be cases of slow or quicker passage. The psychic world does not communicate with earth, at any rate, not in that way. And the ghost or spirit who turns up at seances is not a psychic being. What comes through the medium is a mixture of the medium's subconscious, using subconscious in the ordinary, not in the yogic sense, and that of the sitters, vital sheets left by the departed or perhaps occupied or used by some spirit or some vital being, the departed himself in his vital sheet, or else something assumed for the occasion. But it is the vital part that communicates, elemental spirits of the lowest vital physical world, near earth, etc., etc. Well, I brought out this letter specifically because, you know, we have seance. Seance is, you know, what we have, planchette writing. You know, planchette writing, when you invoke a spirit, the spirit comes and tells you some things, or sometimes you can write some things. Some people have had problems, so they call the spirit and say, hey, where did I lose my document? It's very important. And I'm telling you this because my own father did that. He had lost his document, some important document, so he called a planchette. Some spirit. And the spirit told him, you go there, you'll find it. I think it's a very nice way of getting things done. So those of you who are forgetful, I think we can really start doing that. So these are the spirits. Now Sri Aurobindo is clarifying that when these spirits come, it is not the psychic being, obviously. You are not calling the psychic being from its psychic world, and even, you know, there are Mr. X, Mr. Y. But Mr. X and Mr. Y, the souls have gone away into the psychic world. So what comes to you when you call it, or what you call the automatic writing also, is what Sri Aurobindo calls here, a mixture of the medium subconscious and the vital sheath left behind. So that is the danger of calling these spirits, that what comes is the vital being. Because as we have said, you know, there are many vital beings. When the soul leaves the body, the vital sheath remains behind. So when you call that person, it is that vital body that comes to help you. And so you are under the influence of the vital. So the vital knows your mind very well because they can read your mind. Your questions, your answers, everything they know. So they guide you through that automatic writing. And so he is clarifying here, it's a mixture of the subconscious, the vital sheets, and left by the departed or perhaps occupied or used by some spirit or some vital being. We have also said that our vital being, when it is dangling there in the vital world, can come for its satisfaction into another human being. So when we call some of these vital beings, in the automatic writing, it is they who come. And you know Sri Aurobindo himself used this automatic writing and even wrote a book that was first published somewhere in Chennai, Madras in those days. But later on Sri Aurobindo said, it is not my writing, so you should not publish it under my name. He was only the instrument. So he said, it is some spirit which came, and he knew very well who the spirit was. But he was experimenting with all these things. It was more a part of experiment, not trying to find where he lost his document. So that is an experience. So he has done this in his life, and he disowned that writing as his own. So this is a very beautiful clarification. And then he says, there are spirits of the lowest vital physical world, near earth, etc., etc. A horrible confusion for the most part, a hodgepodge of all sorts of things coming through a medium of astral, grey light and shadow. Now when I think of this medium, I have witnessed actually a mediumistic scenario some years back in Germany. I mean, I never knew it was, but it was quite a shocking experience. I mean, people right in front of me standing, they were invoking the spirits. And lo and behold, some people were gripped by this spirits, you know. And then the whole personality of the person, I mean, I knew that person to be different, but at the time of the scenario, the person had completely changed. His voice had changed, the way he behaved, the way he looked. And some lady could not bear this presence and she gave in. She started weeping profusely and I mean, there were really dramatic events that took place. And it was a very, I mean, we are all in a big hall like this, you know. We are all sitting around and the four or five people were sitting in the middle. And there was a weary atmosphere. I mean, so they had invoked and then we had to stop it saying, no, it's becoming too heavy and we don't want that kind of a presence. So then afterwards we warned the organizers, never do that in Mothers and Children, the seminars like that. We are not here to bring in other persons, other vital beings and all this question of the lower vital elements. So what I want to tell you is this, yes, I have seen a mediumistic scenario where things can go out of control. So coming back, many communications seem to be people who have just gone across into a subtle world where they feel surrounded by an improved edition of the earthly life and think that this is the real and definitive other world after earth, but is a mere optimistic prolongation of the ideas and images and associations of the human plane. Hence the next world as depicted by the spiritualist guides and other seance communicants. Now there's another letter on page 459. What do you mean by a ghost? I mean, I'm giving you all the popular notions. The word ghost as used in popular parlance covers an enormous number of distinct phenomena which have no necessary connection with each other, to name a few only. An actual contact with the soul of a human being in its subtle body and transcribed to our mind by the appearance of an image or the hearing of a voice. A mental formation stamped by the thoughts and feelings of a departed human being on the atmosphere of a place or locality, wandering about there or repeating itself till that formation either exhausts itself or is dissolved by one means or another. This is the explanation of such phenomena as the haunted house, in which the scenes attending or surrounding or preceding a murder are repeated over and over again, and many other similar phenomena. Now, this is interesting because we see a lot of this happening. So this ghost can be what? A mental formation stamped by the thoughts and feelings of a departed human being on the atmosphere of a place. See, this is, I think lots of stories are there, you know, you have movies and all that. Especially in the case of the haunted houses. Now, what he says is that the mental formation stand by the thoughts and feelings of a departed human being. That means, you know, as he has given an example, that's a very good example we can take. That a murder, preceding a murder are repeated over and over again. Say if a person is brutally murdered in a place, then this mental impression stay on. Because it's been a very sudden attack, great brutality, and maybe sometimes it could be not just a murder necessarily, but a person when he departs, he has this, what is a mental formation. Remember the word mental formation. That means there is a kind of a figure which resembles the person because it is a formation of thoughts of and feelings. And this body there remains for a while until, he says, till that formation either exhausts itself or is dissolved by one means or another. So this is what we call a ghost. Either is a mental formation, a vital formation, and then he will give you another third one, something on the lower vital. So ghosts are formations of these departed vital beings, nothing to do with the soul. But they are there. Most cases, as it says, in which scenes attending or surrounding or preceding a murder are repeated. In many film pictures we have seen, you know, the soul, the departed being comes back again and again at the same time to the same place, and we have the same kind of, you know, the atmosphere. So it's a repetition because it's a mental thought or the vital brutality, and it comes. But it can be dissolved by one mean or another, or it exhausts itself. Of course, we have seen this in our folklore also. Sometimes, you know, we satisfy this being and we say, no, you don't stay here. This is what we can do for, you know, to propitiate. Sometimes, you know, in our own ashrams, a couple of times, mother just sent Champaglalji to such places to exhaust, or what mother says, Shivananda says, as dissolve. So they can be dissolved, and in one place mother had given to somebody a message saying in the name and in the name of the mother, with the strength of the mother, etc., I order you to go away from here. So that was a specific message given to somebody by the mother to kind of dissolve these spirits or these presences if they are there in the place. So that was a message that I know of, because the person herself told me. And then there is Champaglal's cases, you will see in his own books. So this is where the mother used for dissolving. And of course, now we have, of course there's been a practice, I think in Champaglal's book we find that using, what is that called, Karpur, what is that? Camphor. That, of course, has been in the tradition. If you use camphor, it dissolves, or, you know, doesn't let these forces come in. Of course, that much I don't know, that except that I remember vaguely having read in Champaglal's book. But otherwise, this message, as was particularly given, and you should get that message. And of course, Champaglal used to go with some water and dissolve, or put water here and there and dissolve. Of course, behind him was the mother's force. He was the instrument. So I remember all this because Shivananda writes about the dissolving those beings. Now the third possibility, a being of the lower vital planes who has assumed the discarded vital sheath of a departed human being or a fragment of his vital personality and appears and acts in the form and perhaps with the surface thoughts and memories of that person. You see, there's so many possibilities. This is a being of the lower vital planes. It could be, you know, where we say somebody is possessed. So it's a vital being actually. It's a vital being who has assumed the discarded vital sheath of a departed human being. This is a very, very strange combination and must be very fearful. Because first of all, it is the vital being. Now the vital being, how does it come? It takes the form of the discarded vital sheath of a human being. You know, when the soul leaves, we have the vital sheaths. So this vital being takes this vital sheath of a dead man, and therefore what happens? It appears and acts in the form and perhaps with the surface thoughts and memories of that person. So this vital being taking the vital sheath, if it comes in front, you will see the dead man again there in front of you. It is not the vital sheath, it is the vital being taking the vital sheath, so you see the same form. And what is interesting? With surface thoughts and memories of that person. So that being will come and tell you, you know, I know everything about you, I was born there, you are so and so, you went there and then you think really that person has come back. Because he's telling you details of your life, recent, past, and the places and all that. So this is again a thing which we have to be clear, and he puts it very beautifully. So this is another formation of a ghost, vital being in a vital body or mental impressions. And then another one, a being of the lower vital plane who by the medium of a living human being or by some other means or agency is able to materialize itself sufficiently so as to appear and act in a visible form or speak with an audible voice or without so appearing to move about material things, example furniture, or to materialize objects or to shift them from place to place. This accounts for what are called poltergeists, phenomena of stone throwing, tree inhabiting bhutas and other well-known phenomena. That of course you remember, this stone throwing, I'm sure he must have really told about his own life. That this is another formation where a being of the lower vital plane who by the medium of a living human being, you see this is a black magic. What the black magicians do is invoke this lower vital being. And once they invoke, then they can materialize themselves sufficiently. So this black magic brings that human, that vital being, and that is sufficiently materialized in order to be able to speak. You can hear its voice. You know, black magicians use these people, go and tell this, go and show this. So this is a reality. Or without so appearing to move about material things. Well, this is there, example is there furniture, but the most interesting one, what we know is the stone throwing. That how the stones were coming down in Sri Aurobindo's own room, not Sri Aurobindo's room, the sadhaks, when they were there in the playground, if the stones would come just down the roof, nobody knew from where they were coming, but from the roof, they would fall on the persons. No, in the guest house, in this guest house there, not the playground, didn't exist at that time, the behind guest house. Flower room? Guest house, no? Yeah. Flower room, Mother Sri Aurobindo never stayed there. That didn't even exist at that time. It was a go down in those days. So this was the guest house. And interesting, of course, the stones would never fall closest to Aurobindo or injure anybody, but they frighten everyone. But that's what we see later on, that this stone throwing phenomena was because of a black magician who was a servant, who was somebody who was not a helper there, who was dismissed from service. So he contacted a black magician who brought in the vital being, and the vital being did all this phenomena of throwing things. Now next is apparitions, which are the formations of one's own mind and take to the senses an objective appearance. I think that must be the most dangerous one. You see, an apparition which are the formations of one's own mind. I mean, you begin to see this person, you know, the other person doesn't see because you have concentrated so much on the person that your mental thought becomes a reality in form. So you see, you begin to see the person everywhere. Because you have given it a kind of a formation by a tremendous point of mental concentration and take to the senses and objective appearances. Next, temporary possession of people by vital beings who sometimes pretend to be departed relatives. I think this we have heard many times in villages, in here and there, people possessed by a vital being. And the vital being, interestingly, pretend to be departed relatives. He would say, you know, I'm your granny who was died here, I'm your uncle who was dead there. And then for some time you invite them, you think, oh, is my poor granny is coming back to me. But these are nothing but the vital beings. To gain kind of an acceptance, they say, I'm your so-and-so relative. So, the emotional acceptance is there, but they come and possess you. Lastly, thought images of themselves projected often the people at the moment of death, which appear at that time or a few hours afterwards to their friends or relatives. My God, really so many different kinds, huh? Thought images of themselves projected, which appear at that time or a few hours afterwards. In the person dying, he projects himself that I am so and so, my body is like that, you know. When I die, I mean this suffering body will go, but I will have this beautiful body. In this kind of a thought images, you know, this, now we can understand the strength of this thought formations, you know, how they can really give a kind of a formation and give an, as he puts it here, an objective appearance. So if you think too strongly, too constantly about somebody or something, they could have an objective appearance. And at the time of death, he says, if you have some such projection, then they can appear to the friends for a while. After the person's death, for a few hours they can be there. Well, you will see that in only one of these cases, the first, can a soul be posited and therefore no difficulty arises. But I didn't go into the first option because that's too much of philosophy. I avoided the first option. Now, in the last couple of minutes, I have one little letter. I'll just read it through. I can understand the shock your wife's catastrophic death must have been to you. But you are now a seeker and sadhak of the truth and must set your mind to rise above the normal reactions of the human being and see things in a larger, greater light. Regard your lost wife as a soul that was progressing through the vicissitudes of the life of ignorance, like all others have, like all others here. In that progress, things happen that seem unfortunate to the human mind, and a sudden accidental or violent death cutting short prematurely this always brief spell of terrestrial experience we call life seems to it especially painful and unfortunate. But one who gets behind the outward view knows that all that happens in the progress of the soul has its meaning, its necessity, its place in the series of experiences which are leading it towards the turning point where one can pass from the ignorance to the light. He knows that whatever happens in the divine providence is for the best, even though it may seem to the mind otherwise. Look on your wife as a soul that has passed the barrier between two states of existence. Help her journey towards her place of rest by calm thoughts and the call to the divine help to aid her upon it. Grief too long continued does not help, but delays the journey of the departed soul. Do not brood on your loss, but think only of her spiritual welfare. This is another last letter on this page 462. What has happened must now be accepted calmly as the thing decreed and best for his soul's progress from life to life, though not the best in human eyes which look only at the present and at outside appearance. For the spiritual seeker, death is only a passage from one form of life to another, and none is dead, but only departed. Look at it as that, and shaking from you all reactions of vital grief that cannot help him in his journey, pursue steadfastly the path to the divine. Last letter. Of course, that is the real fact. Death is only a shedding of the body, not a cessation of the personal existence. A man is not dead because he goes into another country and changes his clothes to suit that climate. Very beautiful quote. Well, that brings us to the end of this section on rebirth.